So I'd like to bring you fraternal greetings from the exotic land of America, where, as you know, the population has a deep desire to bring justice and freedom to what our president has called the dark corners of the earth. I'm not going to speak primarily about media specifically. I actually find the question sort of overdone and somewhat boring. I'll give you the brief version, all you need to know. Media coverage of the Israel-Palestine issue is somewhat biased. Now let me move on to other concerns. I want to talk primarily about messaging and a little bit about the strategic context that we're now in with regard to Israel-Palestine issue and the question of Israel more generally as well. Let me start with a question. Suppose two sides fought a war, let's be hypothetical here, and one of them killed about at least 1,300 people, 80 to 90% of whom were civilians. And the other side killed about 150 people, 70 or 75% of whom were soldiers. Which side is the terrorist? Anyone want to answer that? It's a tricky question. You want to think about it before you answer it. Think carefully.
Lebanon?
This is a very hypothetical. This is a very hypothetical case. The answer, of course, is the one that killed 75% soldiers is the terrorist organization, and the one that killed almost entirely civilians was simply, unfortunately, sadly, we must grieve with them, inflicting collateral damage. Similar question, if one country invades another country and there's fighting, which one was acting in self-defense? Again, a tricky question. Turns out that Israel was acting in self-defense by bombing southern Lebanon up to and including Beirut, and that the Lebanese who fought back were committing what an American politician in the Vietnam era called internal aggression. If you've looked at the history of colonialism and colonialist states, it's remarkable how often us, people who look kind of like me, end up committing internal aggression in our own countries against peaceful, law-abiding people who just happen to be carrying out military operations in a land either far from their own, as in the case of the British in India, or not so far from their own, as in the case of the Israelis in Lebanon. I think you've all heard and said similar things at one time or another, but I think that this has now really come to the fore as an issue that you can think about and that you can talk about. There's two related things. There's the question of terrorism, in which there are, again, two different ideas. One is what's an act of terrorism, another what's a terrorist organization. And the other question of collateral damage. When the United States or Israel kills civilians, even if it kills them, especially in the case of Israel, in very, very high ratios, that is collateral damage. When an organization like Hezbollah fights back and does kill civilians, as in fact anyone who's engaged in war does, but kills them in much lower numbers, that's terrorism. When Israel has extremely highly accurate weapons that they can target very specifically at residential areas that kill large numbers of civilians, that's collateral damage. When Hezbollah has incredibly inaccurate weapons that mostly can't hit anything they're aiming at, but they occasionally kill civilians, that's terrorism. In the United States, and I'm willing to wager in Canada as well, all of the weight in terms of talking about this in a legalistic sense or a moral sense, the entire weight is put on the question of intent. So if you don't intend to kill civilians, then anything you do pretty much is okay. There are still some rules you're supposed to avoid dramatically disproportionate kills. Even the United States, in its own campaigns, when it's bombing a city like, say, Fallujah, there will be some airstrikes that they want to carry out that they won't because their lawyers will say this is going a little bit too far. It's part of a system that works that enables them to go and do the military operations they want, get the results they want, and still maintain sufficient political damage control. So they have a system where, in fact, some strikes that they would carry out just according to, purely militaristic, non-legal considerations. They don't, but overall, as you know, they end up, like the Israelis, killing large numbers of civilians. This question of intent is an interesting one because, first of all, intent is simply, it's just imputed. If the United States or Israel does it, how could it be that they were intending to kill civilians? They just, why would they want to do that? They're like us. In fact, they are us. In the case of people in the United States, why would we want to do that? Well, of course not. In the case of Hezbollah, it's very different. Of course Hezbollah wants to kill civilians. They're Arabs, they're terrorists. They're terrorists by definition, therefore they want to kill civilians. Now, if you actually try to think about the question of intent, then it becomes a rather more murky issue. How do you define intent in the absence of identifiable steps you can see that people take to avoid causing damage to civilians, right? Now, in each case, on both sides, you can find some identifiable steps. As I said, you'll find occasionally the Americans will outlaw an airstrike that otherwise they might have taken, they might have done. The Israelis even much more occasionally, and hardly at all in the case of the Lebanon War, might again call off a certain strike that might have too much of a potential of pure civilian damage. You will also find that Hezbollah doesn't go around killing Israeli civilians whenever they feel like. You will find that in fact, in general, Hezbollah has an announced policy that they only attack civilians in reprisals for Israeli killing of civilians. So if you actually try to look at it and analyze it in a realistic, rational way, getting apart from this sort of inherent Western bias about what the intent must be and who the actors really are and what we know about them just because we know their essence, then you find not only a much more nuanced situation, but you find, I think, and I don't think it's hard to make the case at all, if you actually go through it rationally, you'll find certainly that if you're comparing Israel and Hezbollah, and I'm not saying that you should... I'm not a Hezbollah supporter. I'm not saying that you should support them. I'm simply saying if you compare Israel and Hezbollah, you will find that Israel's actions overall are significantly more terrorist. Terrorist is not something, it's not an all or nothing. It's not a zero or a one. The degree to which they're terrorist far exceeds the degree to which Hezbollah does things. Now, you could look at other considerations, too. What's the difference between a terrorist act and a terrorist organization? Well, every state commits acts of terrorism. Some states, like the United States, like Israel, commits lots of acts of terrorism and support lots of acts of terrorism. I will state that not even the U.S. state and not even the Israeli state is a terrorist organization just as it is. They all have other functions. They all represent large numbers of people and they represent political concerns, some of which are legitimate and some of which are illegitimate. The same is true of Hezbollah. It represents a large number of people. It represents many legitimate concerns. Even if it has committed terrorist acts, that doesn't make it a terrorist organization. Al-Qaeda, on the other hand, I would argue, is a terrorist organization and does not actually represent people. And the concerns, it can certainly put forward a claim to represent legitimate concerns, but it's not doing so in the context of actually having any kind of political backing. Hamas is a more questionable case because it has, before the truces of the last couple of years, it did really actually, terrorist acts were a major part of its strategy on the one hand, but on the other hand, as you all know, it had, again, a large popular legitimate base and represented many legitimate concerns, and especially after the Palestinian elections, has a claim to democratic legitimacy and a right to the use of force that ought to be similar to that of any state. Right, they are a democratically elected government, and normally, in the United States, there's this funny idea that if you're a democratically elected government, you have the right to violate international law and go and bomb other countries. That somehow democracy gives you that right. But conversely, when Hamas got elected democratically, they said, well, now Hamas must renounce violence. A total sort of, this kind of hypocrisy has now come out so blatantly, and the fact that both Hezbollah and Hamas have very clearly demonstrable democratic credentials to back them up means that you can talk about this issue. And I think it's very important to tackle directly this issue of collateral damage on the one hand and terrorism on the other, and to say at the very least that it is not anywhere near as clear-cut as all you people in the media, all of the politicians, et cetera, seem to think. I think that's actually very important, and that goes along with the other thing, which is to really emphasize the question of democracy. Hamas's government was democratically elected in Palestine, and the reaction of the entire world almost was total isolation of the Palestinians and of the democratically elected government. And as you all know, Canada played a significant role in that. Behind it all was the United States, which has actually, since the election of Hamas, been even more extreme in its desires to isolate the Palestinians, oddly enough, than the Israeli government, which is really saying something. But again, they have that democratic legitimacy, and it can be used. It can be used in messaging to a far greater degree than I think either movements in the United States or, I would guess, Canada have done it. And I think it's important to engage in that, obviously in the media, but in terms of all of the work that one does. I think we don't have too long for these talks, so I'll just close with a couple of comments about the strategic situation, which I think is just very different now. Before the Israel-Lebanon war, I was ready to say, you know, I see the Palestinian situation in a complete impasse. I don't see any possibility of it going anywhere. The Israelis have become so intransigent and so racist that at this point it would be a great victory, seemingly, for the Palestinians even to get to talk to the Israelis. But of course they have to bend their knees before they're even allowed to talk to them, which unfortunately is something that Israel and the PLO are working hard on doing. But it seemed to be a complete impasse. The Israeli attitudes had hardened. The Israelis had come up with a strategy which, you know, the Sharon Olmert strategy of partial withdrawal in order to cement their position internationally and with regard to the Palestinians. And the Palestinians didn't seem to have a strategy that was going to be able to stop that. I see the Israel-Lebanon war as an opening. I think in general, it's a general principle that when you win a war, people are much more likely to consider you a legitimate person to deal with than when you lose a war. The ANC was illegitimate. The PLO is a special case because before the Intifada, they were completely illegitimate. Once you have proved your power in a certain way, then you become more legitimate. Had it not been for the massive demonization of Hezbollah as a terrorist organization, when, as I said, the truth is much more complex than that, then you would have expected to see some gain in international legitimacy of Hezbollah, even after, because they beat back the Israelis for the second time, and it's a shot in the arm to the entire Arab world. It's a massive morale builder, but it also means that the Israelis have to take them more seriously. The Israelis had gotten drunk on the idea that they don't lose to Arabs, and now they have lost to Arabs. Tell you one of the most remarkable things, a study by a guy at the Ben-Gurion Institute, aptly named, which showed that during the war, Israelis who wanted to find out what was going on, where do you think they went? They tuned into Hassan Nasrallah's speeches. They trusted what he said more than what their own leaders said, for the obvious reason that he was telling a lot more of the truth than their own leaders were. You have a situation where the Israelis are have become extremely racist, even more so than 10 years ago, where there's right now a right-wing reaction. The proximate result of their loss is going to be a right-wing reaction against the Olmert Peretz government, not a left-wing reaction. But simultaneously, the man they trust now most in the Middle East is Hassan Nasrallah. Okay, that is not a trivial thing. The fact that the Israeli public has been so lied to and misled by people who are not just liars and crooks, but also incompetent. They didn't win the war. Compound that with the fact that, as you saw this even during the war, some neoconservatives in the United States, people who have backed Israel to the hilt, were writing op-eds saying, basically, if we, you know, the condition of our unconditional backing of Israel, the massive amount that we do for Israel, is you guys have to win. You know, we don't back losers. We're America. America doesn't back losers. If you can't even beat this ragtag guerrilla army, then what good is all of the support we've given you? Combine that with the fact that non-neoconservatives in the government, in the State Department, in the intelligence services, in the CIA are now completely fed up. They believe, and I think it's a complicated question, but they believe, which is important, that the United States has been severely harming its interests in the Middle East and with regard to what they like to call the war on terror by its such open and unconditional backing of Israel. There is a great deal of discontent in the United States within the people among the people who make policy, who talk about policy, within the foreign policy establishment, there is an opening. I'm not going to say that it's easy. I'm just saying that I think the situation has changed dramatically for the better, maybe not in the short term, but definitely in the medium term after the Israel-Lebanon war, and that now there are opportunities to try to take advantage of that there weren't. I mean, the flip side of it is that in the United States, in the political level, among politicians, nobody will say a word about this. Your Liberal Party's shadow foreign minister actually came back from Lebanon and said that treating Hezbollah as a terrorist organization is an impediment to actually dealing with the situation, and he was made to resign and so on. But you could not dream of a politician in the United States even thinking such a thing, let alone saying it. During the war, the U.S. Congress passed a resolution basically saying we back Israel totally to the hilt in everything they do in their so-called war of self-defense. It passed the Senate unanimously, and it passed the House with only 8 no votes out of 435. Okay, you can't find anyone who would say that kind of thing at the political level in the United States, even as the policymakers are really, really upset about what's going on. So it's a period of massive contradiction, but there are all these ways to do it. Attack the collateral damage idea. Attack the terrorism idea. Attack the listing that you have in Canada of Hezbollah as a terrorist organization. And attack the democratic question and the election of the Hamas government. These are real things you can do to try to make a dent in public opinion right now in a situation where, you know, there is going to be strategic flux over the next few years, and a situation that looks very hopeless now may become a lot more open if everything goes the way we would like it to. All right.